Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business number 120. My God, how did that happen? That's like a long time. I guess we did start in February 2007, but yeah, still a little bit spooky when you see numbers like that. You'll be pleased to know I've ordered some acoustic panels that should take care of the echo here at the new Risky Business HQ. There's lots of floorboards, high ceilings and glass here, so it's a bit of an acoustic nightmare, but it should be sorted out soon. This week's edition of Risky Business is brought to you by Sophos, makers of all sorts of security software, and they also have an inoffensive blue logo. Calming deep blue, people. No yellow, no red, nothing loud, nothing gaudy. Sophos, calming blue logo, security software. Think about it, do the math. We are, of course, hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting. Thanks, guys. And on this week's show, we'll be chatting with Professor Gernot Heiser. He is the Chief Technology Officer of OK Labs, or Open Kernel Labs. The company makes software for embedded systems, and recently NICTA, that's a government-funded technology R&D lab here in Australia, has actually claimed to have verified one of the kernels sold by OK Labs as being, wait for it, as perfect as you can get. No buffer overflows, no null pointer dereferences, no divide by zeros, entire classes of bugs and vulnerabilities gone. They're impossible on this kernel. The kernel will not allow it. So the professor will be along soon to explain what this all means. And we'll also be chatting with Sean Richmond from Sophos in this week's sponsor interview. So we'll be talking about this virus doing the rounds that affects Delphi environments, Delphi development environments. And that is a fairly interesting little chat. But first up, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Metalstorm Boileau. And Adam, in this first story, which I think is probably about an 8 out of 10 on the hilarity scale, there's a group of spammers in the United States who are trying to coax people into willingly installing malware with the hook of damaging President Obama. Can you please explain what the hell I'm talking about here?
Yeah, so this is pretty funny. There's a bunch of spammers sending out emails that said, if you don't like Obama, come here. You can help the DDoS his site. And then offers a link to a supposed DDoS tool that you can download and install on your box. And yeah, it's malware, and all the poor conservatives get owned terribly.
Yes, the poor conservatives. And you know what I like about this is it is exploiting a vulnerability which is just pure rage, political rage. There's lefty outrage. And there's right-wing outrage. I mean, they're both pretty similar. And I just love it that someone is actually exploiting that to their benefit instead of trying to, rally them around anti-abortion or, saving whales or, one of those, happy left or right causes. It's just like, hey, let's install some software on your machine.
Money.
Yeah, let's just take your money instead.
Yeah, that's the free market of work right there.
That's right. Now, in this next piece, Adam, it's actually an interesting malware story, which we don't see many of. There's a virus doing the rounds that actually infects Delphi environments so that any executable you compile in that environment winds up being, in turn, infected with the virus. And if that virus is run on a computer with a Delphi environment, bang, there it goes. It winds up infecting that environment and the executables that come out of that. Please explain.
Yeah, so I think this is interesting for two reasons. One, because it's a riff on the classic demonstration of this kind of vulnerability from the 70s by, I think, was it Ken Thompson, who wrote the same thing for a C compiler. So it was it would modify the C compiler to insert the code to modify C compilers into anything you compiled with the C compiler, and it's a classic example of the kind of a chain of trust that goes all the way down into your CPU. And I mean, the assumption is that if you can do it for a C compiler, you can do it with the microcode in your CPU coming out of Taiwan Semiconductor. So it's interesting because someone actually implemented this and used it in the wild, which I think is, hilarious and great. The fact they did it for Delphi is, you kind of want to facepalm a bit there because, Delphi.
Well, there's actually some reasons for that you'll hear Sean go into later. But what I'm finding particularly interesting is because I have interviewed Sean already for this week's show, and I have already prepared the feature interview, which is an interview with Professor Gernot Heiser about the NICTA SEL4 microkernel. And really, there seems to be a theme emerging in this week's show, which is definitely all about trust. And it's all about trusting your compiler, trusting your kernel, trusting your code. Very interesting.
Yeah. I think the second interesting thing about this this Delphi story, though, is quite how widespread it is. They said, well, as many as 30% of developers who use Delphi have that have this virus. Like, that's a significant amount, right? I mean, this is a pretty successful virus. It's obviously propagating well. And I guess the sort of people who write Delphi programs are also the sort of people who are likely to download and run Delphi programs. But it's interesting how widespread it is.
So it's sort of like hepatitis C spreading among heroin users.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, I just thought, spreading in an isolated group. So what I'm saying here really, though, Adam, is that Delphi pushers are also Delphi users. I think that's what you're getting at, right?
That is where I'm going,
Oh, now, of course, the big story over the last week or so has been that the TJX hacker has actually also been charged. The guy who's been held over the TJX, obviously a really big hack, really big, credit card scam. He's also been charged with the Heartland and Hannaford breaches. I mean, this guy is Mr. Data Thief.
Yeah, and I think it's great that that we can show that one guy can have such a large impact. That it only takes one well-funded, motivated attacker to really cause some real damage. I think that's something that people who are like the PCI standards people and businesses in general should take away from this. But it does only take one guy to give a shit about your network to actually cause some real damage here. And the numbers they're talking about, like, 130 million credit cards by himself, that's not a bad effort.
It's not a bad effort indeed. I mean, this guy's name is Albert Gonzalez. I've spoken to a couple of people who actually knew him over IRC or had encountered him over IRC over the years. So he's been around, hanging around in some of the sort of slightly dodgier corners. This guy has stolen a god-awful amount of stuff. I mean, he apparently threw himself a $75,000 birthday party. He was, I think surveilled whinging to his mates because he had to manually count something like $380,000 when his note counter failed on him, the poor bugger. I mean, it's really quite incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's also kind of funny that he was a federal informant and the feds were after him under another alias.
Yeah, he was a snitch, wasn't he?
Or credit card fraud, and he was snitching on other people in the same scene, and they didn't realize that he was the same guy that they were looking for.
That is kind of lol-tastic.
So it's also interesting that it will be interesting to see what happens to Jim Jones, the Unix terrorist.
AKA Stephen Watt. And Stephen Watt, of course, is the guy who worked for Morgan Stanley, who wrote the sniffing tool that was used by Gonzalez, even though he didn't directly profit from it. So it's going to be interesting to see what he actually winds up being sentenced to, whether or not he's going to get a custodial sentence or how long that's going to be, whether there'll be a fine, whether he'll be under controlled release and allowed to touch computers.
Yeah, well, I think, for people like me who write security tools, right, this is a pretty important case. I think he did understand to some extent what the tools are being used for, but, given that he didn't profit directly and he wasn't directly involved in it, for example, if I use, Wireshark to commit a crime, should they be going and prosecuting the developers of that?
Adam, I believe they're going to allege that not only did he make specific modifications to make the tool more appropriate for individual crimes, but they're also going to allege that he was due to indirectly profit from the crime. So I believe there was talk of him setting up a nightclub on Gonzalez's behalf. So he would have been made a partner in that business. So I think the prosecution is alleging that he wasn't entirely squeaky clean. It wasn't like he was sitting in a basement on the other side of the planet with no connection to this bloke. I mean, he was asked to customize the tool by a guy who he knew was a criminal, and he did that. So that's the allegation anyway. So I think that's really what they're on about. I don't think it's just a case of someone writing a tool that was misused.
Yeah, well, I think it'll be interesting for us to follow exactly what happens there. Maybe we'll set an interesting precedent for tool developers.
Now, a little bit of an interesting story here in Australia, where we had a Four Corners. Four Corners is Australia's flagship news and current affairs show on the national broadcaster, the ABC. And they ran what I thought was a fairly interesting primer on botnets for Ma and Pa to watch, and that aired on Monday. Now, what's interesting is the Australian Federal Police had taken control of a carding forum called rootu.org, and they'd actually put it onto their own server. The very next day, I believe, after they posted a message onto that carding forum saying, you know, your IP addresses have been logged and you're all very naughty, the actual forum got defaced. Ha-ha.
Yeah, so it sounds pretty funny. Like, according to the reports, the people from the forum hacked into the police box that was hosting it because it didn't have a password or something ridiculous like this.
No, it didn't. There was no MySQL password. I mean, I read the Pastebin sort of write-up of the dude who allegedly did it, but he obviously found some other way to exploit some bug on the box to actually be able to get access to MySQL. But once he got access to MySQL, he's like, oh, they left the admin password blank. What a bunch of lamers, ha, ha, ha.
Well, they are the police, right? A bunch of lamers.
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't see why this is a big deal. I mean, by that stage, they'd already mirrored the whole forum, put it on another box, and then dropped a message on there saying, this box is now the property of the Australian Federal Police. Do you know what I mean? I mean, what possible impact is that going to have on their investigation?
Yeah, I imagine, you know, not much other than just looking a bit silly when it's reported and people don't necessarily, you know, understand all the details that are
there.
Yeah,
I think it kind of annoyed me the way this one was reported. I know the journalist who wrote the story, and I just feel that he didn't... I mean, he went for the gotcha angle, right? Which is the federal police fucked up because they were hosting this machine and it got owned. But, like, come on, man. I mean, if you're hosting one of these carding forums, I mean, there is so much PHP and stuff there that you didn't write. I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to have an entire security audit, a line-by-line security audit of the entire web application that's running the forum? Do you know what I mean? I mean, you're expecting this thing...
Not having a password is a little different to having to, you know, go and audit all the code.
Yeah, but not having a MySQL password, unless there's some other vulnerability in the box, who gives a shit?
Yeah, true.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's okay, it's not the sharpest thing to do to leave your admin password blank on your MySQL database. Agreed. But at the same time, when you're writing that story, you've got to give your readership a clearer understanding of what it is that has actually occurred and what the impact of that has been. Now, this story sort of says there was a whole bunch of evidence obtained and things like that, and it just made it out like this was some serious setback to the Australian Federal Police, and I really don't think it was. So, yeah, I agree that they have egg on their face, but I just don't think it's been reported responsibly.
Nope, fair enough.
And that's my two cents. Oh, now we'll just cover this next piece off briefly, but it turns out that people are starting, and this is something you and I have spoken about over the last couple of years. Turns out there's a botnet out there that is using Twitter for command and control, which is kind of a clever way to do it.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, services like Twitter are and blogging and you know, social networking sites are a great way to drop command and control traffic for bots. Apart, I guess, from the Twitter's lack of uptime these days, maybe it's not the most reliable medium to use.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting though, isn't it? Because they actually just identified this Twitter account and it was pulled and shut down pretty quickly. But I would suspect that, you know, Web 2.0 services like Twitter, like Blogger, like whatever, are probably going to be the method of choice for botnet CNC in the future.
Yeah, well, when we did it with Usenet in the old days, and then people moved it to IRC, so of course it makes sense it's going to follow the kids onto wherever they happen to be now, and that's Twitter. And I think, you know, hiding command and control traffic inside, steganographing it into Twitter posts or whatever, I don't think that's going to be a particularly challenging thing to make it harder to spot which accounts are being used for command and control and which ones are just people, you know, rabbiting on about their crappy lives.
Yeah, no, I think it will be actually, yeah, a little bit difficult to sort out the genuine from the non-genuine accounts, and that's something that we've had Roelof Temming on the show talking about before. He's, of course, the creator of Multigo. Now, there is a new alliance, apparently, Adam, aimed at fighting malware, which I believe will just result in a lot more cooperation between the larger antivirus companies.
Yeah, so it sounds like they're organising a way to do information exchange in a more structured manner, although... You know, I'm skeptical about how good the antivirus companies are at cooperating. I mean, you only have to look at the mess that antivirus naming is still, you know, I mean, in the year 2009, right? How you can't get an agreement on what to call a given virus. So, I mean, if they can't agree on what to call things, I don't know how well they're going to go at exchanging, you know, more detailed data.
Well, I guess this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to change that, I guess. And there's so, when you think about how much duplicated research there is, I mean, they already share SIGs, they do, and they do share a lot of research, but I think really they're realizing that there is just so much double up in their efforts that they could probably even move to a common pool of signatures and a common store for malicious software.
Yeah, and I think it would be a good thing for the industry in general if they could come to an arrangement where that's the case. And it's great to see them working towards it. Although I see what Kaspersky are not involved at the moment.
So I think, yeah, Kaspersky are the most notable ones not involved at this stage. But, you know, it's happening.
Yes, well, we'll keep an eye on it. We'll see whether anything comes out of it.
And Adam, in this last piece, Facebook has apparently disabled 6 rogue applications that phished user details, but 5 more have popped up pretty sharpish. You'd imagine that it would be quite difficult to police such a large application marketplace like Facebook.
Yeah, well, I guess there's, you know, part of the value of Facebook is that people can create these sort of apps so easily, and then they spread very quickly and virally amongst the user base. So, I mean, it's always going to be a pretty reactive position for Facebook to keep up with it. And, yeah, as you say, like 6 down, 5 more turn up the next week, and there'll be another 6 next week.
Yeah, we've often talked about this sort of openness versus security concept, particularly around Facebook. And it will be interesting to see if we reach some sort of tipping point where people get ultra-paranoid and just stop using applications and see if that actually damages the application marketplace.
Well, I mean, even if they were to get to a stage where the applications were relatively trustworthy, there's still such a lot of personal data that, you know, and the relationships between people is of value anyway. And even, you know, even a correctly operating secure Facebook would still be a valuable source of data, I think, for people to mine. Well, I mean, there's, you know, the relationships between people, that's valuable data. There's actually, I think, going to be a talk at KiwiCon this year on some talk on automated stalking via social networks.
Nice, man, nice. I'm sure ex-girlfriends all around the world are glad that you guys are doing that.
Yeah.
Nice one, mate. Anyway, look, we better get going. Adam Boileau, thanks a lot for doing the news with us this week.
Thanks very much, Pat.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there with his reflections on the week's news. Now, before we get into this week's feature interview, I have a job ad for everyone. A large Russian antivirus and security company, gee, I wonder who that could be, is opening up a Melbourne lab. And they're looking for some AV people, not necessarily to be based in Melbourne. I think the geography is a little bit flexible. So if you're an experienced AV type person or boffin, then please email your resume or inquiry to me at jobs@risky.biz, and that will arrive on my desk. I've got some more info on the position here at Risky HQ, so yes, please be in touch if you want to know more. Now it's time to have a chat with Professor Gernot Heiser, the CTO of OK Labs. That company, among other things, licenses and distributes technology developed by Nykta. And there was much fanfare recently as Nykta proudly announced it had successfully proven the robustness of a microkernel, mathematically the SEL4 kernel. That means it's more reliable and secure than, well, pretty much any other microkernel that's ever existed, so these guys say. So I spoke to Professor Heiser by phone to ask him about the microkernel and why it is considered so special.
It's implemented from scratch. It's a member of what's called the L4 microkernel family, which is a collection of microkernels that first appeared about 15 years ago. And we have been, in my group at UNSW and later Nykta, actively researching operating systems design based on this L4 microkernel. And SEL4 is sort of the latest creation in this general family of microkernels, and it's been designed specifically for security and safety critical applications. So unlike other kernels, it has a very security oriented API. In particular, it uses what's called capabilities as the protection mechanism. Capabilities are access tokens. They're like keys. If you have one, it gives you certain rights to certain operations on particular objects. And the whole protection model of this SEL4 kernel is based on capabilities.
Now, before we get too excited, this isn't exactly something you're going to be using to power a GUI-based operating system or a word processor anytime soon. We really are talking about this kernel being used in control systems at this stage, aren't we?
Yeah, well, it could be much more than that. It's generally designed for embedded systems, but embedded systems is a very wide category these days, and they range from small controllers up to large industrial robots and things that have complete PC-like systems inside them. So that is not a particular strong restriction. At the moment, the version we have verified is only verified for ARM processors, and they tend to be used in sort of medium to high-end mobile systems, in particular mobile phones.
Now, your company, OK Labs, already makes kernels that are used in mobile communications devices like mobile phones. Is that correct?
Right, yes.
Which mobile phones can we find the L4 kernel in?
There's a whole range of them from a number of manufacturers. Typically, they have Qualcomm wireless chipsets in there. So one example is the Google Android phone, the G1 that's been launched in the US last year, and I think a Google phone is about to hit Australia or has already appeared in Australia. So they are manufactured by HTC, which is a Taiwanese company. But we are also in phones by Toshiba, Sony Ericsson, number of manufacturers. So basically, in total, there's about 300 million of them at this time, and the number is growing.
So that was an Australian-developed kernel that's being used in the Google phones?
Yes, although it's not running on what you see. It's running on the modem processor, the one that is responsible for the wireless communication.
That's okay. I just wanted a moment to swell with national pride.
What the company is selling at the moment, the OKL4 kernel, is sort of the predecessor of SEL4.
Moving on to SEL4, I mean, from what I understand, the thing that makes this thing newsworthy isn't the fact that you've, you know, increased the functionality of this kernel, but you've been able to verify it in a way that has eliminated entire classes of vulnerabilities. Can you explain that for us, please?
What we have proven is the functional correctness of this kernel. So the kernel has an API which is formally specified, and we have a proof that it goes over several steps, a so-called refinement proof, that shows that the C code is a refinement of that specification, means all the possible behaviors of the C code are captured in the specification, so as a subset of what the specification allows. So in that sense, it's functionally correct. It only has exhibits behaviors which are allowed by the specification.
So that would mean that it's more or less a perfect state machine?
Yes. Well, it depends on what your definition of perfect is, I guess.
But, I mean, it can't find itself out of state. I mean, was that the goal? Or
It can't enter an illegal state.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, right. Now,
I have to be careful not to claim too much. This is there are a few cautions applied there. One is that we haven't verified yet any of the assembler code that's in the kernel, so we only went down to C level, and there is small bits of assembler code which at the moment we just assert by traditional testing, but they're small enough that we don't feel too concerned about that. But we're also working on closing that gap completely.
Well, I tell you what, I won't be satisfied until you've got it verified at the transistor level, personally. You've got to get right down there.
The thing with verification is it always has to bottom out somewhere, right? You have to make some starting assumptions. And in our case, the starting assumption is that the hardware is correct and we have a correct model of that hardware.
And you have a perfect compiler as well, I'm assuming.
Right, yes.
Well, and we saw with GCC recent vulnerabilities that could be introduced into code via GCC that compilers aren't necessarily always doing what they're supposed to.
This is quite true. And from the security point of view, is clearly one of the bigger restrictions in sort of the trustworthiness we achieve with this verification. The advantage you have with the compiler as opposed to something that's part of the operating system is in the embedded system, the compiler is not part of your deployed system, right? It's sort of outside the system. And even though it can introduce bugs, you can sort of hack it retroactively to introduce bugs into the system.
And I guess because you're doing all of your optimizations before you compile, there's less chance of errors being introduced, aren't there?
We are, as a matter of fact, very conservative with the optimizations we expect from the C compiler. And as a matter of fact, there are some tricky operations which C compilers, particularly GCC, tends to get wrong frequently. We've taken them out and sort of generated optimized C code for them, which is straightforward to translate by the compiler rather than relying on more high-level optimizations done by the compiler.
Well, how does this work? I mean, how can you have a kernel that can't be out of state? Is that because you are running a lot of checking on what is actually allowed to interact with the kernel, or it's just that the kernel is correct and can't find itself out of state?
It's just that the kernel is correct, so it will never enter a invalid state, no matter what the inputs are. And in particular, in order to actually prove this functional correctness, we had to, as a side effect, prove a number of other useful properties. For example, the kernel will never trigger an exception, so there's no way it will produce an arithmetic overflow or a division by zero or access memory that it shouldn't access, dereference a null pointer or an uninitialized variable or something like that.
So no buffer overflows, no null pointer dereferences, no pointer errors in general. I'm reading from the list here, no memory leaks and no arithmetic overflows and exceptions. I mean, that's a nice little list of vulnerabilities to strike off the list, isn't it?
Right, yes. And these are pretty much sort of the lists by which kernels typically tend to get attacked. But basically, the way it works is that we proof a lot about the kernel's code. The kernel doesn't do any checking. As a matter of fact, a lot of the checking you would normally have to do can be eliminated because we can prove that the appropriate cases cannot happen. So, for example, there's a bunch of assertions in the kernel. Question, why would you need assertions? Because you prove that the kernel will always operate correctly. Well, what they actually do is they essentially signal an invariant to the proof. Or the having an assertion there means to the person who's doing the proof that this is a condition which is not supposed to happen, so I can prove that it doesn't happen, and then you can compile the assertion out safely. And what you have gained is that the rest of the code can, of course, rely on that particular invariant to hold. There's a very large number of these invariants in the code, and about 80% of the proof effort was actually proving this sort of invariance all over the place.
Now, how do you go about proving the robustness and absolute reliability of this kernel? Because, I mean, what you guys are essentially saying here, and this might be the media people putting their spin on it, but essentially they're saying, look at us, we've created the most mathematically perfect kernel that exists today. How do you go about actually proving that with any degree of certainty?
Well, in the end, a computer program is a representation of a mathematical algorithm. So programming is essentially some use of mathematics, even though we don't tend to think about it that way. In particular, programming languages have a semantic, and every statement in the programming language operates according to that semantic and transfers some state. And so you can capture that statement in the programming language if you have the semantics of the programming language represented in your proofer. And this is essentially what we did. So you have certain conditions you have to hold at certain points, and you can then show that because of the semantics, that no matter what the inputs are, those conditions will always hold. So it's just normal mathematical proofs, just that they happen to be happening with theorems, which are essentially representations of programs. And the proofs are massively complex, of course.
Yep, so this isn't like running some sort of code scanner that looks for coding errors. This is about actually creating a mathematical proof that can mesh and be married directly to the code. So you can say, well, here is our specification as a mathematical proof, and here is the code. Do they match?
Exactly, yes.
Okay, right. Well, that actually makes sense. I understand it. I'm very excited. Let's talk about the immediate commercial applications for such a kernel. What are they?
Well, you would certainly expect this to be used first where people are really very serious about either security or safety. I call that the high paranoia sector. So
we love that factor in the security business. Please,
right.
Go on.
So on the security side, this is things like national security applications or financial transactions. In the safety side, it would be wherever you have embedded systems that could potentially kill people, like medical devices.
Or an Airbus.
Cars and planes, yes.
Oh, so that's the immediate application. But surely, the kernel out of the box can only do so much and provide you with a means of processing information. Surely whoever's going to buy this kernel is then going to need to develop an application, which could be an absolute bug-riddled nightmare. So how far does it put us ahead, actually having this stable kernel?
Well, as always, in security, no one can ever prevent you from building something that's insecure, right? You can have the best tools and the best platforms that allow you to build the most secure systems. If you do something silly with them, then you can always create something that's insecure. In that sense, if you have the most secure lock in the world, if you don't lock it, then it doesn't help you. So in that sense, yes, building a secure system on top of this kernel is more than just using the kernel. You have to have the right approach for really understanding what your security problem is and how to use the mechanisms the kernel provide you in order to then come up with something that is equal as secure as the kernel allows you to be. This is something we are working on. It's certainly not a trivial problem, as you well know, because the security is always tricky. It's always easy to get wrong. But what we are doing at the moment is working on sort of some industrial type demonstrator that really takes this from having the verified kernel to being able to present a provably secure system that consists of not just the kernel but some end user functionality.
Well, this is going to be my next question: is can you apply this same methodology, this same proof methodology, to applications that run on top of this kernel?
In principle, yes. The problem is that these sort of proof techniques scale very poorly. So we have, with a 25 or 30 person year project, managed to prove a kernel of about 7,500 lines of code. Kernel code is more complex than application code tends to be, so you can probably, with a similar effort, get a bigger system at application level. But that's not really a lot, right? Even if it's 20,000 lines of code, there's a limit to what you can do with it. The proper approach is not trying to verify all the software in the system, but only verify the security or safety critical components, the so-called trusted computing base, and then use that to confine the rest of the system enough to make overall security or safety guarantees.
So would you be able to verify something like, for example, an IP stack or a protocol stack?
People have done that, or at least been working on it. Typical opinion is that you probably don't really need that, because you don't want to depend on the functionality, the correct functionality of something like an IP stack. You have to, for availability. I mean, the typical security challenges can be characterized as privacy, integrity, or confidentiality, integrity, and availability. And for availability, you need sort of some degree of functional correctness in order to ensure that what the service you want, you can actually get. If you leave out availability, then you can get security without having, in a networked environment, without having to verify your IP stack, because you can encrypt the data, and all you need is to ensure that the data is actually coming out at the end, and then you can decrypt it, and whether the IP stack is functioning correctly or not shouldn't affect your integrity or confidentiality. Assume some system which has to maintain the confidentiality of some data that's part of a bigger system, and you can think of national security applications, but you can also think of sort of payment systems where you need to have your keys, maintain the confidentiality of your keys. So you would use the mechanisms provided by the kernel to encapsulate these critical components in some compartment, and then be able to prove that no matter what happens in the rest of the system, the integrity and confidentiality of that particular compartment is maintained. So in that sense, you would have to verify the code that sets up this compartment, that gets the data in there and controls how it can get out in there, etc. So something that's in terms of the code complexity, massive orders of magnitude less complex than the whole system or an IP stack or something like that.
So what do you think the chances of being able to run this proof on something like Internet Explorer are?
Pretty slim.
Pretty slim. All right, well, it's good news for the for people out there who work with embedded systems, that's for sure. Professor Gernot Heiser, thank you very much for joining us here on Risky Business, and best of luck with the commercialization of this technology.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Professor Gernot Heiser there on the line with a look at the SEL4 microkernel and what makes it groovy. Now, at this point in every week's show, we do a sponsor interview. Our sponsors pay our bills, and in return, we give them a voice in this sponsored commercial segment. But as you'll hear, it doesn't mean that they get to tonk on and on and on about their own products or services. Most of the time, they just get to show you all out there in listener land how very, very clever they are. And clever they are. In today's sponsor interview, we're chatting with Sean Richmond from Sophos about W32 Induck. That's the virus you heard Adam and I discuss in the news segment. It spreads by infecting Delphi development environments, which in my book actually makes it fairly interesting.
Well, yeah, it is interesting because it's using a different vector. It's not original in that case. There are some others that I'll touch on that have done similar things. But yeah, it's something that instead of spreading from file to file and parasitizing other files or spreading as a worm and just dumping copies of itself, what it does is when you run an infected executable, it looks for a Delphi build environment on your computer. And it will then go and find the sysconst.pass file in the runtime libraries. And that's the sort of like the standard lib in a C compiler. It contains standard constants. And it's used by almost every build, or the Delphi compiled unit, sysconst.dcu, is used by just about everything that you build using Delphi. So what this does is modifies the sysconst.pass, recompiles it into the Delphi compiled unit, and then everything you build from that moment on will contain a copy of W32/Induck. So if you're a Delphi development shop and your production environment gets infected, then all the code that you spit out, all the executables that come from your Delphi build environment, will in fact contain W32/Induck.
How cool. I mean, I'm sorry to actually think that something that, you know, the quote unquote bad guys have done is cool, but you would admit this is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's different. It looks like a proof of concept, actually.
Well, it doesn't have a payload, does it?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to do anything else apart from infect the build environment and then spread. But the surprising thing is it's been around for a while, not quite certain how long. And what we're seeing, as soon as we started detecting this, we got over 3,300 unique samples of infected stuff. And a lot of people, and I've seen it on the forums and through other vendor sites, a lot of people are saying, well, this must be a false positive because I've had this program for ages. And in all the cases where we've had a sample, it's absolutely right, it is infected.
I suppose it's one of those things where it's hard to actually detect because, well, it's not doing us any harm. It's not exhibiting any malicious behavior. It's just sort of replicating.
Yeah, that's it. And it's very similar in that way to, a thing called Gatman that was built in 2006 that was actually targeted at the IDA disassembly tool. And what that did was the executable contained an IDC script, which is the scripting language that lets you automate parts of the disassembly. So if you fired it up in an IDA environment, it would build a script that would trojanize, or that would infect the environment. So the idea of that one seemed to be to get into malware labs because the idea is that you might exchange your IDC scripts, but you would have your executables. You wouldn't be exchanging the exes that you're working on.
Hmm.
But you might send a script to say, hey, here's my decompilation and things. And if it can infect the IDC scripts that you're using, then you can infect the malware researchers' tools. And in case, so that's a similar kind of thing. But yeah, Induck is very unusual in that it is using a sort of side channel to get in there. And as my colleague Paul sort of mentioned, I said it reminds me of a paper or a lecture that was given by Ken Thompson back in 1984 called Reflections on Trusting Trust. And Paul said, well, it's sort of like reflections on trusting trust.
Well, that is a typical Paul Ducklin response, I must say. That is exactly the type of response he would come up with in
but,
that instance.
That paper, it's available on the web, and it was Ken Thompson's like Turing Award lecture in 1984 about how, well, the problems of trusting source and trusting code that you didn't build yourself from scratch. And that talks about writing a Trojan compiler that every time you compile a login, it will inject some code that inserts a backdoor, and that will never be in the source. You'll never see it. And it made me think of that.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, because under this case, if your compiler has been subverted, you can't even trust the code you compile yourself. I suppose that's what you're getting at.
That's exactly it.
You mentioned there were 3,000 samples in the wild just among Sophos customers. That seems to be reasonable penetration for a virus that you would have thought would have had such limited spread.
Yeah, it's quite a large number. I mean, about 6% of our sample set is Delphi. And Delphi appears to be like one of the favoured tools of banking Trojan authors, which is quite surprising. So it does get there, and we get thousands, tens of thousands of samples a day, but that many unique files does imply that it has got into a fair few environments. Mm. And in fact, this morning I read that a German magazine on their cover disc has shipped a CD-ROM that contains infected utilities.
Infected with this particular critter? Or?
Infected with Induck. So in a particular utility that's on the disk called Tidy Favorites, that's infected. And amongst the things that we've seen, there are quite a few types of code that are probably dodgy anyway. So they're things that have been built in Delphi because it is a rapid application development tool from infected build environments.
Let me ask you something. Would you ever install something called Tidy Favorites?
Probably not.
I mean, that's got I'm infected with a virus written all over it, doesn't it? Some little utility for performing some niche function that you've never heard of that just screams, you know, download me Mar and Par. I'm
that
harmless.
One's for organizing a browser's list of favorite websites, which seems slightly redundant anyway.
Yeah, just a little, yeah.
But one of our researchers actually did the task of going through and just looking at the sample set and taking out everything that, you know, didn't have a company identifier in the executable, because that's, you know, usually when a production house builds something, they'll put in version strings, they'll put in their identifiers. And he came down to like 275 unique entries without question marks and things. And some of the samples are things like cheatadvanced.net, Grand Chase Hackers, Radical Cheat, you know, a bunch of stuff that's probably not desired anyway.
So are you theorizing here, Sean, that perhaps this particular virus might have got into the Delphi environments of a few of the lower-level bad guys?
Yep.
Right. Well, at least that's a straightforward answer.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that that we did notice is that when we were looking at some of the samples and detecting, you know, seeing what in the sample set may have already been detected or may have already been infected with Induck, is that quite a few things were being identified as Trojans. And so we were worried a bit about, you know, is there something weird going on? And it turns out that, or it appears that several of the authors of banking Trojan type software use Delphi and have been infected themselves.
That's so freaking hilarious.
It is, isn't it? They can't keep a clean build environment and keep their systems virus free. So I love that.
That's funny. Maybe it's a new market opportunity for you guys. You know, maybe it was actually you guys who wrote this so that you could actually expand your market to cover the bad guys as well. Oh, hey, it's all money. Money doesn't know where it comes from.
Old chestnuts. Sorry, can't have that one.
Can't have that one. I mean, You're pretty much screwed once your environment gets to this point, aren't you?
Well, not really. It is possible to undo it because it does back up the original sysconf.pass file.
Oh, that's just...
That's very kind of it.
It is very kind of it, isn't it?
So you can get back or a fresh install of your Delphi system will get you back a clean sysconf.pass, and then you can recompile that to the sysconf Delphi compiled unit, and then your build environment is back there. The problem is that everything you've built and shipped while the environment was infected cannot be disinfected. Because unlike a normal appending virus or something that will, tweak the entry point of
This goes in as source code and then gets compiled, right?
Well, it's actually compiled into the object. So in that way, the things that are infected with Induk, the programs executables that we can detect with Induk in there, there's no way of pulling that out because it's just written right into the normal code. There is no clean state because it was built as an infected file. So the problem there is that, if somebody's got a tool that they actually use and they need that's detected as Induk, what they're going to have to do is go back to whoever manufactured that tool and say, can I get a copy that isn't infected?
Now, you mentioned before that you think it's a proof of concept. So would you imagine that we're eventually going to see similar types of viri carrying harmful
viruses.
Payloads? Viruses? I don't know, man.
It's viruses.
It's a whole argument in your little industry that just...
No, that's just an English grammatical argument. But anyway,
I can tell I've just pushed a little button. do you imagine that we will be seeing viruses written with this, that use the same technique here, but deliver a malicious payload?
It could happen. I don't see any reason not to. And one of the things about the Delphi environment is that the runtime sources come with the package, so you've got those sources. Whereas in other compiler environments, you may not install the compiler's own source to the system. So that might be something that mitigates. But yeah, I could see it as being an experiment that may have a payoff. If you could.
But it's a technique that's particularly suited to Delphi. I guess that's what you're saying.
Yeah. That's the thing. It just seems that whoever wrote this obviously knows Delphi better than anything else, because technically it's not impossible to do this in any other system. And it sort of speaks to the thing of you must keep your build environment pristine.
Mm.
Here at Sophos, we use a divided network, and the production room is severely controlled. So no code goes in, nothing runs on that system. Everything gets built there, and including the tools to build the tools, if necessary. So it's completely isolated from the rest of our environment so that we can't screw up.
Makes sense. Okay, well said, Sean. And, mate, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business this week.
It's an absolute pleasure, Patrick.
Sean Richmond taking up this week's show. That's it for this week's show, everyone. Now, don't forget to check out Risky Business 2 this week, because Paul Craig did a very interesting interview with a couple of guys at the OWASP Day in New Zealand in regard to exploiting Firefox extensions, and that's up now, so go check it out. This week's track is by Morph. Hope you dig it. And until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.